All right. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Vincent Racaniello. Dr. Racaniello has received a Bachelor of Arts degree in Biological Science from Cornell University and completed his PhD in Biomedical Sciences at Mount Sinai School of Medicine under Dr. Paliz, studying influenza viruses. As a postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Racaniello joined the laboratory of Dr. David Baltimore at MIT, where he worked to generate the first infectious clone of poliovirus. Dr. Racaniello is currently a professor of microbiology at Columbia University Medical Center. His current research is focused on the coronaviruses, specifically how they interact with the innate immune system and their viral pathogenesis and viral discovery in wild animals. Dr. Racaniello has received awards including the Irma T. Herschel, Cyril Scholars, L.A. Lilly, and the NIH Merit Award. He also serves as on the editorial board of the Journal of Virology and PLOS Pathogens. Also, Dr. Racaniello has contributed greatly to microbiology education, not only writing our textbook, but he has helped create the netcast This Week in Virology and This Week in Parasitism. He writes blogs about virology and uses other forms of social media in order to try and bring microbiology to a broader audience. Without further ado, Dr. Racaniello.
Thank you.
So a first question for you. With your passion for education in virology and microbiology, who or what stimulated you to enter the field of virology?
All right. So here's my little abbreviated backstory, which will answer that question. So I graduated from Cornell in 1974. Okay. And my parents had wanted me to be a doctor, but I didn't want to be a doctor. So I graduated and had nothing to do. So I went home. I went back home, which was northern New Jersey. And I got a job as a lab tech because I really liked lab work in college. And this was mostly doing microbiology, identifying bacteria. It was a really interesting job, which will take way too long to tell you about someday. I'll tell it on the podcast. But I read a book called Fever, and it's the story about the first emerging infection that really we knew about, Lassa virus in Africa. I think I have it here. Anyway, that really inspired me. It was a cool story about the emergence of this viral infection in Africa. And in fact, part of the story took place here at Columbia, although I didn't know anything about Columbia at the time. And I thought that was cool, and I wanted to study viruses. So I had worked about a year, a little bit less than a year, and I started thinking about going to graduate school. And I was applying to a couple of programs, but I didn't know what I was doing. I was at home. I had nobody to advise me, right? And one night I went to dinner at a friend of mine who I'd graduated from Cornell with. His name was Ed Kilborn. And his father happened to be chairman of microbiology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine here in New York City. So I went to his house, and after dinner he said, "So Vinny, what are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "Well, I'd really like to go to graduate school and study viruses, and I'm applying to these master's programs." And he waved his hand. He said, "No, forget about that. Come to Mount Sinai, apply to the PhD program." So this was August, you know, and the PhD program starts in September. So I went for an interview and I got in. And it was a combination of Fever, the book, and Ed Kilborn, who, by the way, just died last year. So he was pretty important for my career because he told me to go to this department. I took it on faith. I said, "Okay, I'm going to go there." It turned out there was Peter Pallese, a brand new assistant professor working on influenza virus, so I joined his lab, and the rest is that's it. So that was what got me started. Matt, not a bad story, right?
Continuing along the theme of social media and everything, we looked at your This Week in Virology podcast and everything, and some of them were really, really interesting. But out of all the podcasts they've done so far, which one has been your, like, either your most favorite topic or your most interesting, or which one related to your work or something like that?
You know, I love them all, but I'd have to say the first one, because that's the one we got started with. I think every week I'm privileged to talk about virology with these great colleagues of mine. And it all started with number one, with Dixon Depalmier. I think it was called West Nile Story. And I had been listening to podcasts for a while, and I thought, gee, I could do this with viruses. So I was really excited to do it. I got a recorder. I went a couple of mics, went to his office, and it worked. So, you know, I figured we'd do it for a couple of weeks and then it would go away. But people started listening and they started emailing and telling us how much they liked it. So it grew and grew. So I like every episode. There's none that I think is terrible. I learned a long time ago, sometimes I'd finish recording and I'd say, oh, that was a terrible episode. And then I'd listen to it. It was really good. So you can never tell when you're recording. But I think they're all great. But if you want me to pick one, I'll say the first one simply because that was the beginning.
Thank you.
What made you interested in using social media basically to access a broader audience for virology and virology in general?
Well, so it started with blogging. You know, in the early 2000s, people started developing software that made blogging easy. And I started to read these blogs. And I thought this was a really good way to reach a lot of people. And I noticed that people could write blogs on, you know, writing software or cooking or any kind of interest that they have. People, it would engage people. And, you know, I'd been doing virology research for years. I wrote textbooks. I wrote articles. But I never felt that I had such a reach. You know, I figured whenever I published a paper in Journal of Virology, maybe 10 people read it if I was lucky. And I really wanted to reach more people. So I thought blogging would be a good way to do that. And it was a pretty easy thing to get into. I could sit in my office. I learned pretty quickly how to do it. And I started writing. And I was amazed at the kind of reach that you can get. About 4 or 5 years later, podcasting started growing in popularity. I have a pretty long commute here to get to my office in New York City. And I was tired of listening to the radio, so I discovered these podcasts where I could listen to whatever I wanted to. And I really liked that. I really liked learning different areas and hearing people talk. And it was informal, not professionally produced, just people recording themselves. And I really liked that. And at one point, somebody said on a podcast, if you're passionate about something, you can do a podcast on it. And so I said, well, I am passionate for sure about virology. So that was the genesis of doing it. And again, I figured, as I said, it would not last long. And it turned out to have this huge reach and reaching thousands and thousands of people. And as these two media were developed, then along came Facebook and Twitter, which I thought was a good way to sort of promote both the blog and the podcast, but also allows you to connect with even more people. So we have a Facebook page for This Week in Virology, facebook.com/thisweekinvirology. And we have over 3,000 fans there, which I think is amazing. And it's just another way that you can reach more people with your message. So that's how I use the social media to reach people and say, look, here are some virologists. We want to tell you what we do. We want to teach you about virology. And people love this sort of thing. And it's a very easy way to reach more people. So that's really why we're using social media.
How do you come up with the topics for your podcasts?
It's pretty easy. You know, in the beginning, I would look at table of contents of journals and just pick out an article or two that really looked interesting, and that's easy to do because there are just so many articles on viruses that are useful. But in the past couple of years, what I do, I have a Google search set up, a keyword search for virus or virology, all right? And I have it emailed to me every day, the results. And that way I pick up stories that are in the popular press dealing with viruses. And those are the ones that I think people are going to see. So, you know, a hantavirus outbreak in Yosemite, big West Nile outbreak this year, the new coronavirus in the Middle East, those stories appear in a Google virus search. You know, the more obscure Journal of Virology virology stories, you're not going to pick up on Google, and the public is not going to know anything about them. And I learned that it was good to take a story that impacts the public and explain it to them. So now what I do is look at my Google search. But as we've grown more popular, what I find is that people send us stories as well. So every day I get two or three emails. Could you explain what's going on here? And, you know, I just found this interesting story about an infection. Can you explain what's going on? So it's kind of evolved from looking at journals to the Google search, and now crowdsourcing the topics as well. So we could just do shows on what people ask us to explain. I have a whole list of things that we're backlogged on that we haven't gotten to yet. But that makes it immediate because that's what people want to hear about. Okay.
With the topics you have covered, which topic did you have the most response from your listeners?
The most downloaded episode, I think it was CSI Virology. I actually have the stat page up right here. I can tell you. Here we go. So we get 50 to 60,000 downloads a month, which is really amazing. All right, yeah. So the highest download is episode 110, CSI Virology. We talked about a story where they used sequencing basically to show that a single person had intentionally infected a number of people with HIV. The second one is number 105, Finch's score again, the finding of integrated viral genomes in the Finch genome. 15,000. So the top one, CSI, 17,500. Finch's score again, 15,500. I thought the H5N1 episodes would be a big one, but they're not in the top 20, interestingly. So the top 15 or so, they all have more than 10,000 downloads each. So I don't know why CSI Virology, maybe because CSI is in the title, right? Put CSI in all the titles and see what happens now. Yeah, so there you go, CSI Virology. So the whole catalog is there and archived, so people can always go back, and they do. It's not always just the current episode that's downloaded, but people go back and download all of them continuously. So that's the nice thing. The other nice thing is that you have this archive of episodes, 208 so far, and they don't really go out of date because a lot of them have basic information in them. So a lot of people seem to like to go back and listen to them.
How do you find the time to between like all the This Week in Virology and your research and like I would probably assume like teaching to at Columbia University too. How do you find that time to coordinate between all that, between all of your responsibilities?
Well, I'm a time lord. You guys know Doctor Who?
Yes.
Pretty good. I'm impressed. I take time of other people and I rent it. People's free time, I rent their free time and I use it. So I always feel that you can do whatever you want as long as you want to do it. So if someone asks you to do something and you say, I don't have the time, it really means I don't want to do it, because you can always find the time to do things. And I realized that what I do is just get very efficient about using my time. And when we didn't have internet at home for 2 weeks, I realized how much I work at home, because I go home at night and interact with my kids a bit. And then once they go to bed, I work. I couldn't do that. So I tend to try and be really efficient. I want to do all these things. So I want to have lab, obviously, and I want to do the podcast and the blog and everything associated with it, because I really, doing lab work is great. I mean, running a lab, I say I don't do lab work per se anymore, but running a lab I love, I have always loved. So there's no question about doing that. But I love all this other stuff as well. And so that's a motivator. it makes it, when you really want to do something a lot, it makes you figure out how to do it. So I just got very efficient at using my time well. And I got down to where I could, for example, reviewing papers or grants, I could get really efficient and do them really quickly, but still thoroughly. So, you know, there are more things I'd like to do, but now I've reached a point where I don't have time to do it. I mean, I have ideas for 5 more podcasts, but I don't have time. And it's really sad because I would really like to do them, but they're going to have to wait until something opens up, you know. So, but that's, you know, I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's how I do it.
In your recent article on social media and microbiology education, you expressed the importance of conversation and how these are great learning opportunities. Sort of on the terms of the last question, is there any other manner that you think would be valuable to share scientific conversations? And are there future plans for your social media and or like blogs and podcasts?
So I think a conversation is a good way to teach because it's casual. So for, you know, having a couple of people sitting around talking and not only talking, but being themselves, having their personalities come out, you know, if they joke around, that's good because that's them. It tends to break up the seriousness, if you will, of learning, and it just makes it easier. So I always felt that would be a good way to teach. You know, when we teach classes, we stand up in front, and the first way of teaching is lecturing, and that's okay. But you know, that can get, if you don't have a really good lecturer, that can be trying after a point. A discussion is way better, right? So a person leading a discussion is much better than a lecture, but there you're limited. If you have a big class, you can't really do that. And having a couple of people sit in front of a class and having a discussion would be great, I think. So that's why I think the podcast is really good. Other ways to do that. I think that at meetings, you know, we have this traditional model for a scientific meeting where you get up and you do a PowerPoint. I just think having a talk show format would be so much better. You put a couple of people in front and have them talk about their work. You know, it turns out you don't really need PowerPoint to get your point across. I was live tweeting the ASV this year from Madison, right? So I have an iPad in front of me, and I'm not really watching the slides. I'm listening to the speaker and typing, looking at my iPad. And I realized for most of the talks, I didn't really need the slides. If I just listened, I could figure out what was going on. So I think a situation where, let's say there's a new discovery, you want to have a session at a meeting, and you have 4 people who can talk about it, they've worked on it. You get them up there with a moderator, you have an audience, and you have a discussion. You could even invite the audience to ask questions as well. But I think that would be much more compelling, especially if you let them relax and be themselves and have fun. You know, you can always have the slides later and available if people really want to see the data, or you publish your paper and you see the data. So I think this conversational style really fits into a lot of different situations, not just a podcast, but can you be used for teaching, can be used for meeting, and who knows what else. You know, it's typically an entertainment mechanism, but I really think that it fits well in science. So I want to use this more and more for different areas. As I said, I have other ideas for podcasts that I can't get to at the time. But I think, judging from the response, I mean, we get 50,000 downloads a month for a pretty obscure virus podcast. And that's a very specialized area, right? If you broadened it, you could probably get even more people. And I think the compelling part, besides the conversational aspect, is that you have experts in a field. You don't have someone who's trying to cover everything in science and really can't speak from any depth or any passion about it by definition. But if you get people who are really good and they're talking about what they have a passion for, that's where the beauty comes, and that's where the power of the medium comes from. So I think it can be really powerful. So, for example, if we were today, if I had a couple of my TWIV colleagues with me and we did a podcast, you'd probably have a blast listening to us. And if you could ask questions as well, it would be a lot of fun and you'd learn a lot too. So I think it's a really powerful medium. Is there anybody on the other side of the room? I hope not. If you are, you should move over. See, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 seats left.
There's a whole other side of the room.
Okay, fine.
Here we go. High tech.
There's a couple of people there. Yeah.
The post-Thanksgiving.
Oh, this is the first class after Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah.
So we couldn't find a big schedule.
Yeah.
You guys, people can ask questions.
And in one of your Twitter videos, polio is not dead. You discussed that the majority of the population are administered the only killed vaccine that does not replicate in the gut, whereas and potentially affect those who are not immunized. Would it be beneficial or even feasible to administer only the attenuated version of the virus? And what would be the disadvantages of this approach?
So right now, what we do is most of the world gets the infectious attenuated vaccine, the Sabin vaccines. And the idea is that, well, the U.S. has switched to inactivated vaccine. In the year 2000, it switched completely. So our the American intestines are becoming more and more susceptible to polio, all right, because the inactivated vaccine does not immunize your gut. It's an injected vaccine. It gives you immunity in the blood, but not in your gut. So a virus could enter, a polio virus could come into the U.S. and spread from gut to gut. So you would be infected in the gut. You would shed virus. You wouldn't get sick because when the virus got into your bloodstream, it would then be neutralized by antibodies produced by the inactivated vaccine. So the virus could actually spread throughout the country that way. And eventually it could find a pocket of people who aren't immunized, which do exist in this country and could cause disease. Now, that hasn't – there's possibly one example of that in Minnesota a couple of years ago. There was a small outbreak of polio in an Amish community. We still don't understand how the virus got to that community, but it could have been some scenario, as I just suggested. Now the idea, one day when polio is eradicated, the world may switch to just using the killed vaccine or the inactivated vaccine. So that would be a negative, that everybody's guts would be susceptible and the virus could still spread. The alternative to keep using the Sabin vaccines is not good, because as long as you use those, when you get those vaccines, they revert to virulence in your gut and you shed these viruses into the environment. So right now, except for the U.S. and a few other countries, most of the world uses the Sabin vaccines, and as a consequence, the sewers and the environment are full of reverted or virulent Sabin viruses. So that is one reason you have to stop using the Sabin vaccine at some point. Once you've eradicated the disease, if you keep using the Sabin vaccine, you're continuing to introduce virulent viruses into the environment, and you really can't stop vaccinating, which is the goal of WHO at some point, to stop vaccinating. So you have to stop using Sabin vaccine, and the idea would be to switch to the inactivated vaccine. Whether or not the gut susceptibility that would accompany that is an issue, we don't know, but I think it's the only alternative. Because if you switch to an inactivated vaccine, then you stop shedding infectious viruses into the environment, and then maybe one day you can envision stopping immunization. Because it really would be sad if we eradicated polio, but still had to immunize indefinitely against the vaccine itself, right? So we can't have that, and so that's why we're going to have to switch to the inactivated vaccine with the accompanying caveats.
Can you speak some on the polio eradication effort that like the current situation?
Sure. So when I started here at Columbia, there were I think, a reported 350,000 cases a year of polio globally. So that's reported. It may be a tenfold underestimate. Who knows? So there was a lot of polio globally. As of this year, these numbers are really amazing. I'm looking at polioeradication.org, which has a day-by-day summary. 2012, year-to-date, globally, 193 cases. And last year, 2011, year-to-date, it was 536. Total in 2011, 650. So we are on the way to having substantially fewer, maybe less than 200 cases of polio this year. And what is most amazing to me is that there has been zero cases of polio in India this year. And India was historically one of the most problematic countries for reducing the amount of polio. There were just thousands and thousands of cases. And I always thought that we'll never reduce polio in India. And here it is. It's eradicated for a year. Of course, the other countries where there still is polio, the main ones are Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria, and those account for most of the 193 cases so far this year. Nigeria still has polio because they stopped immunizing in 2004 for a year, and they still haven't recovered from that. But presumably they should be able to do that at some point with sustained massive immunization programs. Pakistan and Afghanistan are more problematic. There's a lot of conflict, as you know, in that area, and that prevents people from carrying out immunization activities. There's also, the Taliban has said, we're not going to allow polio immunization because it's a CIA plot to get our blood samples, et cetera. So you have all kinds of reasons why, you can have a great vaccine, and if you can't get it to people, it doesn't do you any good. So I was always skeptical that we could eradicate, given these non-scientific issues. But the success in India has totally changed my mind. I think that's an amazing accomplishment, that they got it together to basically massively immunize everyone and keep it up, and go village to village and ascertain who has not been immunized, put a mark on the door of those people who have been, and just hit everyone, and it worked. So I have pretty good confidence that it will work eventually. I don't know how long it's going to take. It's not going to happen in a year or two, even though we have 200 cases a year. That is still 20,000 infections because the infection rate is 1%. The symptomatic rate is 1% of infections. So there's still a lot of virus around, and it's going to take a while. I would say 5 to 10 years. I think it can be done. I'm pretty optimistic. What happens afterwards is another question. As I said before, I think we're going to have to keep immunizing for a while, and we're going to have to switch vaccines. We're going to have to figure out how to make a lot of the inactivated vaccine because we don't make very much of it at this point. So that's going to be somewhat of a challenge. But I think these are doable goals. So I'm pretty optimistic about it. And at the beginning, I was very pessimistic. But as I said, I've changed my mind.
Why was polio historically such a problem in India?
A lot of sanitation issues, a lot of standing water, not good sewage management. And of course, it's spread in fecal material. So, raw sewage flowing into local aquifers was a big problem. Extreme poverty in some areas, a lot of crowding, poor living conditions, and a huge population. I mean, really, huge. All those things combined made it a perfect scenario to get polio transmission. I mean, there are other countries where China has a lot of people, but they are not as concentrated in most places, and the sanitation has overall been controlled to a greater extent. And then there are smaller countries that have equal issues with sanitation and healthcare, but there aren't as many people. So India basically had all those things right, and it was a great place. And that's why it's even more amazing that that it's been, at least it's been halted for now.
With polio eradication hopefully reaching an end game, what research is yet to be completed on poliovirus, and what is the benefits of doing this research?
Well, I think there are quite a few really interesting, more than a few. There are many, many interesting things that can be done. I mean, polio has been so well studied for so many years that we have great reagents. We have a lot of people still engaged in it. And they fall into two areas. There's some basic things that you can do in cell culture, and there's some very interesting pathogenesis that you can do in animal models. For example, in some burning questions about pathogenesis, what limits the tropism? Why does polio only infect the gut and the CNS? We know that the interferon system is involved, but how so? And why is it that the central nervous system is so susceptible to infection? We don't understand that. How does the virus get from the gut to the central nervous system? We know that it can spread by the blood. We know that it can go by neural pathways, but specifically, how does it do that? What are the mechanisms? How does the vaccine, the Sabin vaccine, work? Even this is a really amazing thing. It's a hugely administered vaccine globally, and we don't really know how it works. We know that it reverts in every individual that gets it, and then those individuals shed virulent viruses into the environment, but we don't know the basis for how it works. And I think that would be nice to know, because you could use that perhaps to design other vaccines as well. So those are some of the really interesting questions that I think need to be answered. Once we do eradicate, you know, there's a window of time where you have to start curtailing the work you do on the virus. You have to bring it to a BSL-3 plus, I think it's 3.5 containment, which will make it not impossible, because there are a number of, well, three, there are a lot of three facilities around the country, but three and a half or whatever the level is, maybe not. So it's going to be harder for people to do the experiments. I suspect that, you know, as with anything else, if someone is motivated, they'll do it. You know, there are plenty of other viruses to work on, of course, and so it may just be easier to turn to something else. So, you know, these are all great questions, but if we can't do it, you know, there's not unlimited money for doing scientific research, even though I think there should be a lot more than there is. It's not unlimited. You have to make intelligent choices. And given the choice of working with a virus that's where it's really expensive and you can get similar data with another virus, then that the answer is quite clear, I think.
Piggy-tailing off of that, working with virulent strains of polioviruses, in one of your articles, you say that working with virulent strains of polioviruses will need to be halted once global eradication of polio is complete. Why is this necessary? Would it not be important to continue studying it, even if it's similar to other strains of the coronavirus?
Well, yes, it would be. I think, yes, you're right. It would be important to keep studying it. You know, we work, the idea is that you don't want to have it worked on under BSL-2 conditions any longer, because the virus is theoretically eradicated and there's no longer immunization going on, right? So you should not put yourself in a position where you could readily introduce infection into the population again. That would be tragic, because then you'd have wasted all this eradication effort. So the idea is that you would have to have very high level containment, BSL-3.5, right, to work on it. So you it's not that you can't work on it, but you would have to work on it under containment conditions that simply aren't available everywhere. We don't have a BSL-3.5 here at Columbia, for example, and I don't think that Columbia would build one for me, to be honest. They wouldn't even build me a studio, you know. So, not a BSL 3.5. So, you know, it's a technicality. Yeah, we should keep doing some work for some of the reasons I mentioned, but it'll just get harder and harder. And you can imagine in countries that don't have a lot of resources but still want to do research, that's not going to be a priority for them anymore because it's going to be too expensive to do. I do think we have some time before we get to that. It's an interesting discussion point. And whenever I give a polio lecture, I bring it up because it's interesting. And I, you know, smallpox is the only other virus where we've had to deal with this. Of course, as soon as it was eradicated, we stopped working on it. But of course, that's much more lethal than polio. And there are other similar viruses that one could work on and get similar information. So, you know, it's a good discussion point going forward. What do you do? Should you work on other model systems, or should you spend the money and build the right laboratory for containment? I don't know what the answer is, but it's interesting to talk about.
I didn't realize that the reversion rate with the vaccine was that high.
Yeah.
Is there a mouse model that reflects that people can look into what is really necessary for causing those reversions or required for causing those reversions?
So mice are generally not, even the transgenic receptor model is not orally susceptible unless you get rid of the interferon system. So if you cross the receptor transgenics onto an interferon receptor knockout mouse, then you can feed those mice and they will replicate virus in the gut. So in those animals, you could study reversion. But in fact, you can even get reversion in cell culture. If you take the vaccine strain and grow it under certain conditions in cell cultures, you can get reversion quite readily. And that's why when the vaccine is manufactured, it has to be made under very prescribed conditions. Otherwise, you get a high percentage of revertance. But there are lots of interesting questions associated with it. And, you know, the main reversion events are single-point mutations in the 5' non-coding region. And we don't know anything about, you know, these sequences were done in the era of Sanger sequencing, where, you know, you only see changes if they're a big fraction of the population. No one's done deep sequencing to look at other parts of the quasi-species to see if there are other sequences that go along with reversion and so forth. So there are a lot of interesting questions. I think, in fact, the reversion probably makes the vaccine an effective immunogen. I think early, when you first take this vaccine orally, I think its replication is slow, so your innate system probably kicks in. And then once interferons are made, the virus then reverts and it replicates a little better. It gives your immune system a boost. That's my theory. And one of the other questions I meant to someone asked before, like what are the interesting questions to be answered? Why do some people get vaccine-associated polio? The rate is about 1 in 1 million or 1.5 million doses, first doses of polio vaccine. So the virus reverts in everybody, as far as we know. But why do these rare individuals get vaccine-associated polio? I don't know the answer, but I would bet if you sequence their genomes, you'd find mutations in innate immune response genes that I bet would explain it. But the opportunity for doing that is fading as we have less and less polio globally, of course.
If there's such a high percentage of reversion, how long after, assuming that we do get eradication, how long after would we have to keep monitoring systems in place to basically be assured that it is eradicated?
Probably 5 to 10 years. So my scenario is that let's say you declare eradication, no more cases for a year, all right? Let's say that's the standard globally. And during that year, you continue to immunize. At that point, you have to make a decision whether you're going to switch to the inactivated vaccine or not, because within a year or two, you could start doing that. And then I would say for 5 years after stopping the Sabin vaccine. You have to monitor the environment. You have to look in water supplies, the aquifers, and look for polio viruses. And then at some point, you're not going to find them anymore, and you're going to say, I think that would be about 5 years or so. And then maybe you could stop immunizing. All right, but remember that your confidence in saying there's no more polio is only as good as your sampling and your detection. So you can't sample everywhere. You can't sample every milliliter of potentially contaminated water. So you could be taking a chance that there's some undetected polio virus around, but you have to make that decision. It's always a cost-benefit analysis, and I've thought about it a lot, and I think 5 years of no polio in the environment would probably be sufficient to say that you could stop immunizing. But remember, you've always got viruses in labs that you don't know about, and of course you could always make the virus from the sequence. It's pretty easy to do that, so you always have to be prepared that it's going to come back. I would say that you should assume it's going to come back at some point, and you should be ready for that to happen.
We're still here.
Yeah, I see you. No problem.
In one of your recent videos, you were talking about, I guess, like the use of silk to stabilize antibiotics and viral vaccines.
Right.
One of the questions we possibly thought of is, can this be possibly used in conjunction with polio virus eradication efforts, or is it only for specific like viral strains, or what are the complications with it?
So the story is that you can use silk, fibroin, basically, to mix it with vaccine, and it forms a film that you let it dry, and it forms a film that in which the virus is really stable to heat. So for the vaccine they tested, which was measles, mumps, rubella, normally within a few days at 37 degrees, the vaccine is inactivated. But with silk present, it lasted weeks at 60 degrees centigrade, which is amazing. So the problem with vaccines is that most of them have to be kept cold, and that makes it difficult to bring them in places where, you know, there's not a good cold chain. And most of the vaccine failure in the world, there's a number in that paper, over 50% of the vaccines have to be thrown away because they encounter heat at some point. You know, the electricity fails. Even in a developed country like ours, as you can see, I didn't have electricity for 12 weeks, for 12 days. If I didn't have, if I had vaccines, you know, they would be gone. So using silk could really revolutionize that. And I don't see why you couldn't use it for polio. You do have to keep both kinds of polio vaccines frozen. Both the Sabin and the Salk vaccines have to be kept frozen until use. And in fact, the WHO developed a kerosene-fired freezer that it used to deliver vaccine into remote areas where there wasn't electricity so that they could get vaccines to where they had to be deployed. So, you know, depending on how long it took to approve of the silk process, it could be used in the current polio effort as well, especially if it goes on for another 5 or 10 years. I absolutely think it could. I don't see any reason why the effect would be specific for the one vaccine that was tested in that paper. So I think it has a lot of potential. There's another approach, too, that we talked about in an earlier TWIV, which was to use sugar. Another approach besides silk is to embed the vaccine in a sugar matrix, and that stabilizes it also against temperature inactivation. So there are lots of very interesting new approaches in vaccinology. I think those are going to make impacts in maybe even the medium term for polio.
About Vince, what advice would you have for careers in virology to the students nowadays?
The same advice for career in any science. Science is really hard. When I came into science, it was much different than it is now. you know, we were pretty assured of getting a position. We were pretty assured of getting funding. Now it's totally, totally different for many reasons that we don't have time to go into. But my advice would be that make sure you love it. And it's the only thing you can imagine yourself doing. If you can see yourself doing something else, then probably you shouldn't do science research. You have to want to think about science, you know, most of the day, do lots of experiments, not get paid a lot, work really hard, and be really dedicated. And if you can see yourself doing that, then it might be something for you. The other thing is that not everybody has to be a principal investigator. You know, when I went to graduate school, you went and you got trained by a PI because you were going to become a PI, and that was the only track that there was. But nowadays, there are lots of other things you can do with a science degree. You don't have to be a PI. And it's probably wrong for us to keep training people as if they were going to be PIs. So just think of the other things that you could do. You know, you could get a PhD in virology and not want to be a PI, but maybe you want to go into business, maybe you want to go into writing or some kind of communication. You'd be a fabulous writer with a PhD in science. We just had a virologist here, John Udell, last week, who gives a wonderful talk about science careers. So I the last TWIV I did with him, and I really suggest you go listen to it. And there are some links in the show notes to a couple of papers he's written, and there's a YouTube video of his talk, which are really compelling. He gives really good career advice, and it would be useful. So that's TWIV number 208.
We have about 3 minutes left. Do you have any closing remarks for us?
How many of you have listened to TWIV? Raise your hands. Okay, you other guys, my assignment is to pick an episode and listen and send in a question, and I'll make sure that Michelle keeps track of that. But really, there's nothing better than science. All right, science drives the world. It's not business. It's not law. It's not anything else that we do. All those other things are great, but the reason we are where we are today is because of science. Science and technology drives all of the stuff that we can do. It's really amazing. So we'll always need scientists, and we'll always need dedication. And unfortunately, we've gotten to the point now where a career in science doesn't seem all that appealing to a lot of people. But we'll always need science. There's always going to be a need for people with science careers, and we'll figure out how to make it more appealing. So don't get discouraged. If you really like it, just do it. And above all, my advice to you is to be curious, right? If you're not curious, then it's no good. But if you look at something and say, how does that work, that's the right attitude for being in science. By the way, I recorded this whole thing today. So if anyone wants to be immortalized, now's your chance.
Now we can see who was really here and paying attention.
Thank you, Vincent.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for your listening. Time. Bye.